The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
There's no more ambiguity. No more people going to try and figure out what category do I fit in or not. If you're 18 or older and you've been primarily vaccinated, go get boosted.
That's happening just as winter-like temperatures are arriving in the Midwest, and with them, a COVID surge. Four Midwestern states have the highest rates of new COVID cases. Michigan is on top. Here, cases rose 86% compared to just a week ago. Michigan is now seeing its largest influx of cases since the pandemic began.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's surprising numbers, isn't it? It doesn't seem to be getting the same media coverage that we had not too long ago. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. I'm Drew Mariani. We have a packed broadcast for you today. I hope you can hang out with me for at least the next 3 hours. I'll get you plugged into, the most important issues of the day and what you need to know, and also some fascinating spiritual things. In fact, one of those things is something that impacted and changed my life. And when I say that, I mean that in a very literal way. I met a great mystic in South America. Her name was Maria Esperanza, and she's now a servant of God. Her cause for beatification is underway. And when I met her, my life changed. I got to tell you, today's the anniversary of her birthday. Okay. She was born on this day, and I've invited the vice postulator for her cause to stop by. Now, you might have heard of Padre Pio. You might know who he is. If you want to know that God exists, you have to hear a little bit about her life and the way God can work today in our own day. So often we think that the events of great saints, happened long, long time ago, right? No, we got many great saints in our own day. And I think Maria was one of those. And of course, I think you'll find that conversation fascinating. Plus, there's a surge in witchcraft amongst this younger generation. And I do want to talk about that. I think it's important to just get you plugged into what's happening there. We'll dive into that with an exorcist a little bit later and what it means. So stay with me. But right now, my heart goes out to the citizens of Waukesha and really the state of Wisconsin and to our country. There's such mystery surrounding what happened. I'm sure you heard about the tragedy. If you haven't, let me just quickly tell you what went down. Waukesha, by the way, is a little suburb of Milwaukee. Beautiful old place. I've been there several times. There was a Christmas parade that was taking place. They were singing Jingle Bells. Parents lined the streets with their strollers and their blankets. And everybody was having a great time. It was great to get back out after COVID-19 and get ready to celebrate the holidays. And this is such a Midwestern quintessential, parade, Christmas parade. And what happens? All of a sudden, a red Suburban, comes racing through. A guy named Darryl Brooks was behind the wheel. He's a person of interest in the case right now. And this SUV, it just plowed into the Christmas parade. And you could see bodies strewn. They were crumpled up. People quickly ran into action. They sprang around them. People grabbed kids, just threw them in the stores. Nobody knew what was going on. I think the town of Waukesha actually went on a lockdown. The guy behind the wheel apparently had a long rap sheet and had been released on about $500 bail back in February. Then he was released again on $1,000 bail earlier this month after allegedly running over a woman with the same SUV. I'm like, does it get any stranger than that? Really? So the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office says that they are conducting a review of the bail terms, and what they're saying now is that they were inappropriately low. I would think so. $500? Really? $500 bail? When bail's put up so often, you only have to pay 10% of it, right? So at this point, law enforcement officials aren't speculating on a motive. Who knows why he would do this? And again, we live in a time where everybody has a cell phone, and a lot of this was captured on videotape. So we'll be praying for the victims and the alleged perpetrator today, of course, during the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. And I would invite you to join me for that. In all this, there's a lot of theories. Some people think, is it domestic terrorism? I don't think so. If this was a terrorist attack, he would have plowed right through the center of that crowd. He wouldn't have tried to swerve around and hit other people the way he did. Is it in response to let's say, the Rittenhouse case. It just finished in Kenosha, not too far away, right? Again, I don't think so. I don't know, but I'm just looking at the events of this. What purpose would that serve? Taking your car and running over kids and parents, innocent people. It makes no sense to me. If you're angry at Kyle Rittenhouse, it's amazing the division we have in our country. And one of the crises that I think is being manufactured. Not that it's not real. I do think there are racist people in the country, but I certainly don't think America's racist. And I've said this to you many times. I don't believe that. I think we're now a beautiful amalgamation of different people. I mean, look in your community, look in your office, look in your schools, right? I don't believe that. I don't believe a racist nation would elect Barack Obama to two terms. I don't believe, and we can go through a whole lot of things. I just don't buy it. That's just my personal take on this whole thing. But, you know, if you looked at MSNBC, and I'm pointing them out because I actually saw a news clip today of after the Rittenhouse case was adjourned, after they made the jury went ahead and they came up with their verdict. And look, we have to believe in the system. Those jurors deliberated for days. They saw the evidence. We saw, you know, the way the prosecution had. MSNBC only broadcast during that trial, the prosecution. And then when it was over, I saw one commentator, she should lose her job, come out and say that, you know, the halls of Congress are filled with white supremacists, and this little white supremacist, referring to Rittenhouse, you know, got away with murder and blah, 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 blah. And they were going off on this type of tirade. I had seen an interview this past weekend with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott that I've been wanting to share with you. And I thought, this is probably an appropriate time. There are people who want to foment this idea that we are a racist nation. I'm not going to buy into it. We're not. And there are a lot of people like Senator Tim Scott who is black, you know, and was raised in poverty and has now achieved some of the highest levels of government and is making a difference. He's eloquent. He had a radical conversion to Christ. And I know his faith guides and inspires him. He sat down last Saturday, I believe it was with Brian Kilmeade, and he shared some of his thoughts on serving in what is really a historic role as a first American senator for his great state. Now, he comes from the Carolina, South Carolina, and he had said, like, the South Carolina of my parents and grandparents is certainly not the South Carolina of today. It is a different place. But take a listen to some of what he has to say. I think it deserves to be heard. Listen.
I found myself in a position I had never even dreamt of being, becoming a United States Senator for the great state of South Carolina. I never even dreamed that was possible.
And the historic nature of you being named as an African-American in South Carolina, what role does that have in you saying, I have to make the most of this?
Well, I think I'm burdened by history in many ways, meaning that so many times the conversation starts off about the first African-American senator from the South. Blessing and curse at the same time. My theory is I'm not called to serve black people. I'm just called to serve Americans. I think it says a lot about our country, and it says a lot about South Carolina that they chose me and then elected me to be their senator. I like talking about the evolution of the Southern heart, because the state I live in is not the state that my grandfather was born in, not the state that my mother was born in, even though both are called South Carolina. This South Carolina is different. We have evolved so much in so little time,
right,
that access to real opportunity, being judged by your character and not your color,
right,
is my reality.
You'll talk about race. You'd rather not.
Absolutely.
You rather not, even though it's necessary. But you rather talk about the issues in your party and the country.
I prefer just to be one of 100, to be one person representing a state and the nation, not the black guy, but just the guy. But that's not my plight, and I'm okay with that. I've embraced it. But I also like talking about people who've been marginalized. And disproportionately, a lot of African Americans have had that experience. But in South Carolina, that's true for my rural folks as well. Rural South Carolina has been without representation.
Right.
Rural America has been without representation.
What did you and what did Republicans learn, if anything, from now Governor-elect Youngkin's campaign?
Well, I've been trying to say it for a long time, and he just did it. Happy warriors attract a bigger crowd. That politics is a game of addition. That talking about education is something that we as Republicans should always focus on. Having parental involvement is key. I've talked about the importance of school choice and education equality for a long time. He has run on those issues that resonate with the average person in this country. If we were to win in 2022 and beyond, we're gonna have to just talk plain English to our folks. And when we do, when we champion the causes that they believe in the most, we're gonna be okay.
No, I just love what he has to say, and he's right. You know, Father Rocky, who is our chief executive officer here, and Bishop David Ricken, who was on the program with me last week, so many others who I have a lot of respect for, they have said, you know, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And it's easy for us to take a look at all the problems in the culture and see how bad it is. But I think the senator was right there. I think Senator Scott, when he says people like happy wars. Yeah, and that's what always surprised me about the narrative we have seen coming out of certain parties right now. We're in a dark winter. You know, look at this. They highlight all the problems and the darkness and the racial divide and the inequity. And, you know, they cry out for social reproductive justice and all the rest of this stuff, right? Let's talk about brighter days. Let's talk about the greatness that is America. America's not a bad country. We're the greatest nation on the planet, period. We do more for other nations than any other nation in the world. We're champions of liberty. We're an experiment. And we're young. We're only 200 years old, but we're an experiment in liberty, in ordered liberty. We're a great nation. We have our flaws. Every family does, right? There's no question about that. But we are a great nation. And I am tired of hearing about how bad we are, how racially divided we are, how much injustice there is. And I'm not excusing it because there is. And wherever it is, it should be rooted out. But I think the good outweighs the bad in this country. And I think Senator Tim Scott is one of those guys. I hope he runs for even higher office at some point in time. I was really impressed by his demeanor and all that he had to say. Hey, one more story here, and I want to talk about what's happening internationally too, because I've been talking about China, but I want to talk about what Russia has just done. You heard about them shooting a satellite out of space? I'll fill you in on that and some of the moves that they're now making. We do live in troubled times. Right now, there is a shortage, though, of truckers, right? 80,000 truckers. That's how many we need. That's a shortage of 80,000 truckers. That's compared to pre-pandemic levels, and even then, the industry was constantly looking for help. I saw a story, and this is all part of what we're hearing today about the mandates, right? I saw a story that 2.5 million truckers may refuse. I mean, they might lose their job. They might quit is what they're saying. You know, they'll lose their job if they refuse to get vaccinated. They'll be forced out of their job, and that's going to cause even more serious problems for the supply chain than we already have, right? It's a troubling situation. I heard a snippet of a very interesting interview with Chris Spears, the president and CEO of the American Trucking Association, during a House Transportation Committee hearing on the supply chain issues. Spears shared just an internal survey showing that 37% of truck drivers not only have said no, but they said hell no to the Biden vaccine mandates. Here, take a listen.
When we're talking about how the drivers would feel about a vaccine mandate, what kind of reactions are you getting from them on that? Just all of them required for a vaccine to do business.
Yeah, I want to be clear and qualify this, that this isn't about being pro or anti-vax for us. You know, we've been moving the vaccine, PPE and test kits. So this is something our industry is very forward leaning on. But in our sample survey of our fleets, it came back as 37% of our drivers not only said no, but hell no. Now, let's just take a conservative number. Let's just say 3.7%, not 37%, were to actually leave rather than get the vaccine. That'd be catastrophic. We're already short 80,000. That's going to inflate to 250,000. So for us, you know, we've tried to be very clear with the administration that if you do this, I understand the logic behind it, but if you do this, these are the consequences. So if you're trying to solve the supply chain problem, you know, you're actually compounding it and actually hurting the very problem that you're trying to fix on the vaccine side. So, you know, be careful what you wish for here.
Yeah, so if you think getting products from manufacturers to stores is hard right now, I'm just saying, wait to see what happens if the courts uphold the Biden administration vaccine mandates for businesses. If we lose 2.5 million truckers, oh, America will be on its knees, man, that's for sure. So I just hope we get this all right. A lot going on. There's one final note on this whole vaccine thing, and I do want to take a look at some international news. You might be glad you're not in Austria. Did you hear what happened there? This is a pretty important story. First of all, the government there told all unvaccinated people last week they couldn't leave their homes except for work and to buy necessary supplies. And the police, by the way, will be stopping you. They're going to stop and check your vaccination status. Like, what? You can't leave your house except for work and supplies? And then the police are going to be saying, let me see your papers? So the government is demanding that starting in February, all Australians, or not Australians, Austrians, that they have to be vaccinated. There's no exemptions. None. I don't care. No religious exemptions, no health exemptions. If you want to live in Austria, you better get vaccinated. If not, you're going to get a fine around $4,000 or a month-long stint in jail, whichever. You know, which we give to those who don't comply fundamentally. So, and if you don't get your booster shot, say you got your two shots and you don't want the booster, $1,600 fine or a month in jail. And there's going to be another lockdown of that country in 20 days. And then only the unvaccinated, you know, will be locked down after that. I never thought we'd see this. I heard somebody talk about what happened, you know, around late 1930s or 40s in Austria at that point in time. So there's some weird and eerie parallels. Last week, and I want to put this on your radar, it's an important issue. Russia sent a missile into space. They destroyed a satellite that it owned, one that had been dead for a while. And the reason Russia did it was to get rid of the satellite. That's what they say. My reading of this is Russia saying, hey, America, the rest of the world, NATO, if you oppose what we're about to do, will blind you. It was a show of strength, and it was a warning to our country. Not only did they do that, but as you know, they've been amassing troops on the border of the Ukraine. They've been conducting war games there. They have 100,000 troops now gathered on the border, and there are expectations that Russia will invade Ukraine early next year. And if that were to happen, it's not clear what the U.S. or NATO would do, or even what they could do. Russia has been after Ukraine ever since they took Crimea back in 2014, and they've been waiting for the right time to do it. With President Biden in office, it seems like right now is the right moment. I'm joined right now by Dr. Shaul, Dr. Jeffrey Shaul, longtime friend of the program. He's the president of the Alexandrian Defense Group and an expert in counterinsurgency warfare. He joins me today. Doctor, always a delight to have you. Good afternoon.
Always nice to be here talking with you, Drew.
Well, when I saw, it's my pleasure. When I saw that satellite get blown out of space, and I thought, what a mess, because the debris gets into orbit. It can affect other satellites. I know a lot of people in the ISS tried to take cover in the International Space Station. They weren't sure what was going to happen. Russia shooting down one of their own satellites. Some could argue, it's innocuous. It's not a big deal. They were just trying to get it out. What were they doing? What message were they sending? Am I reading too much into this?
No, you're reading the language correctly. But I actually think it was more of a defensive warning, because they are extreme. There's so much going on in Ukraine. Zelensky, who was coming in promising for better relations with Russia, and I genuinely think he wanted that, basically got hijacked right off the bat by some very, very hard right guys, the Azov battalion, who have told the Ukrainian government that they'll do what they want, and if anybody tries to disarm them, including the Ukrainian government, they'll disarm the government. So wow. These guys are the ones who they're not just anti-Russian. You know, the term has been used so lightly by the left over here. They call somebody a fascist and a Nazi, but these guys are real Nazis, okay? They hate Jews. This is why Israel won't support America in its efforts to back up Ukraine, because they know who's behind it. It's this far, far right group. And look, I am I'm on the right of the political spectrum, so it pains me to have to use this term, far right, because that's where I've been always accused of being. But these guys really are there, okay? This is not some leftist telling you that.
Go ahead, Doctor. Sure. No, finish your thought. No, please.
Well, they're driving the political scene, and they want war with Russia out of revenge. They're just crazy. I can't figure them out. I've tried to figure them out. They're still mad over, and perhaps rightly so, over what happened in the 20s and the 30s with the devastation of Ukraine and the kulaks.
Let me ask you, though, about Ukraine, because I know we only have a few moments for you today. Why is Russia... What are they doing on the border? And then in addition to that, is Ukraine part of NATO yet? They're not, from what I understand, or are they, right?
No, and according to NATO's own doctrine, they can't, I should say, what do you call it, the Constitution, they can't join NATO while there's an ongoing conflict. But
to follow up on that, if Russia invades Ukraine, then they're not part of NATO, who goes to their defense?
Heaven only knows. I don't think Russia would invade unless they thought that NATO was moving in force. So it's sort of a big game of chicken going on. Is the best way I can describe it. I'm trying to keep things short here for you. Russia, the border with Ukraine is a highly vulnerable and, as they say, indefensible border. You have to remember the long memories there of going back to the 1940s and how the Germans just steamrolled through there. And the only big defensive barrier close in that area is actually the Dnieper River. So if Russia actually saw a big movement of NATO into Ukraine, I think they would go then. I think they'd roll things up to the Dnieper, if you don't want to go nuclear, that is, if you want to stay conventional.
Let's just say they take it over, right? Let's say they do. Some experts are saying, hey, in the new year we might see that. I just wonder, what the ripple effect of that is. What about other former Soviet satellite countries like Poland, right? Isn't Poland right now is having this border dispute with Belarus, right? Belarus, I should say.
Yeah, the whole thing is very shaky, and all I can tell you is that I don't think Russia wants to do that because they don't want the repercussions, which I think would be quite direct, that they would not be selling. America would then be supplying the gas to Europe, and that would end Nord Stream 2, which is there but not operational just yet. And maybe this is about Nord Stream 2. I don't know, because I know that there are strategic thinkers in the State Department who don't want that coming online. They think it'll make Europe too dependent on Russia. So there's a lot of things up in the air on this one, Drew.
Yeah, well, look, I'm sorry we had such short time today. I'd love to have
you
back.
I wish
we'd talk about that
much longer so we could go through the history, because the history here is so incredibly important. But
Let's do that. I'll bring it back. I'd love to talk to you about China. I'd like to also find out your thoughts on Austria and all that we're seeing. There's a lot to talk about.
Oh, boy, yeah, doesn't that make your hair stand on end? What's going on in Austria?
It really does. That's Dr. Jeffrey Shaw, his book, you might want to check it out. It's called The Last Mandate. Make sure you check that out. You can find him at alexandradefense.com. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. A look at life you won't find anywhere else.
Hey, great to be with you today. Thank you for joining me, and I promise to do that. I'll give you a look at life you won't find anywhere else, whether it's dealing with current events or international affairs or politics or finance, but most importantly, the faith. And, God has got a strange plan. He's got a plan and a mission for each and every single one of us. You know, years ago, I never, ever thought I'd be sitting behind a microphone here. As I've shared with you before, I thought I'd either anchor television news. God led me into the world of documentary filmmaking. I loved it. And during that process, back in, I guess it was 1989, I'll give you a little quick backstory here. I was in the jungles of Africa, And I was, oh, I was present for the very last apparition of the Blessed Mother to a girl named Alphonsine Momoriki. And Alphonsine had visions of the Mother of God. And when she came to her, they told these children of a bloody future for Rwanda. This is 89 that this happened. When I was in that country, it was a beautiful country. It's the Switzerlands of the Africa. It's this tiny little landlocked country in the heart of Africa. People there had big hearts. They were wonderful. I never in my wildest dreams hearing some of these messages, I never reported on them because I thought, that's not going to happen, right? That's ridiculous. It's too dark, too macabre, too apocalyptic. Within 5 years, civil war erupts, and that nation literally turns into a bloodbath. The Hutus turned on the Tutsis, and we saw one of the greatest genocides in recent history. When I was there, I bumped into a Mariologist. His name was Father René Laurentin, and he was documenting these visions. He had traveled the planet. And I told him I was working on a documentary of these reported visions around the world. He said, well, then you've got to go to South America. There is a woman down there. Her name is Maria Esperanza. You know, and Esperanza in Spanish means hope, right? Maria, hope. So he says, you got to go down there. She's unbelievable. The Virgin Mary's been appearing to her throughout her life. She's had these mystical experiences. 1976, she started appearing in a place called Betania. And in 1984, 105 people were present there, 108, something like that. Every single one of them saw the Mother of God. They could see her as the seers in Fatima or any other place. It's normally for the visionary only. And he says, you got to go down there. And so I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. We scheduled a trip. I was one of the very first Americans ever to go to Betania. I remember coming down there. When I walked into her home, she says, I've been waiting for you. And I thought that was such a strange thing to say. And she began to talk to me. And she had these unbelievable gifts. Many people compare her to Padre Pio. She had the ability to read souls. She knew everything about me. I wasn't even married at that point in time. I was dating my future wife. She knew about my father. She knew he liked to gamble. She knew he had a drinking problem, you know, and she said these things. I'm like, how would this woman know any of this? She revealed things to me that nobody really knew. And I was awestruck. I remember departing Venezuela for the first time. This was, I think it was 89. I was down there for the very first time after that experience in Rwanda. And when I was there, it was like something out of a movie set. I mean, all these people, we were there at night. The moon was full, the water where, you know, so the healing waters of Betania flowed. Maria was in the center. They were praying. I came in there to say goodbye to her, and I'll never forget it. She told me I'd be back, and true to her prophecy, I'd return to Venezuela probably 13, 15 times. I would do a documentary on the events that happened there, and there were Eucharistic miracles that unfolded. I've spoken to physicians. I've spoken to bishops. I've spoken to people of all walks of life that have been profoundly impacted by Maria Esperanza. She'd end up becoming the godmother to one of my children. She prophesied the birth of my first daughter. It's just an extraordinary, extraordinary woman. And she is, I think, up there with Padre Pio when you talk about some of the greatest gifts, some of the greatest, being one of the greatest mystics of the 20th and 21st century, because the miracles that surrounded her were so vast, and they're among some of really the best documented in church history, and not since Padre Pio, you know, this incredible wonder worker, did we encounter a seer, a healer. She bore the wounds of Christ. Come Holy Week, her hands would get contusions, and they'd erupt in these bloody wounds during the Passion. She had this odor of sanctity, this inexplicable, beautiful fragrance that often came from her. Competent eyewitnesses saw her levitating off the ground. So respected was she by the local episcopate, she was allowed to have our Lord have the Eucharist in her own home in a chapel that she had there. And she embodied so many mystical gifts that it's been amazing. I was with her when she bilocated at one time, so I know this stuff might sound strange. Some of these words you may not even understand. Bottom line is, if the church sees it, one day she may be raised to the altar. She may be declared a great saint. Right now, she's a servant of God. Then she'll become venerable. Then she'll become beatified and then a saint. So I often tell you, turn to the saints, but turn to those making their way to sainthood, the blesseds, the venerable. servants of God. I think they intercede in a powerful way. They have special charisms. Clearly, Maria did too. I could talk for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, just on her extraordinary life. But I thought it'd be better today if we brought in the vice postulator for her calls, and that's Father Timothy Byerly. And he wrote a great book too. I want to get you plugged into it. I know you're probably saying, "I'd love to learn more about her." Grab a pen and paper. We'll get you plugged in. Father Tim, welcome back. It's good to have you here with me today.
Great to be back, Drew. Great to be back with you.
Always a pleasure. You and I have a deep connection and love for Maria. I remember in 89 when I first met her and I came back, I don't think anybody knew about her. And I put her in the Marian Apparition of the 20th Century film and then would go back and do a later one. She was extraordinary, even predicted some of what I think we're seeing today. But, you know, maybe you could, Father, share a little bit of her life story for those who don't know or put into context. I talked, of course, about some of these preternatural gifts that we've seen, but maybe you could talk about who she was, the charisms she had, and give a little backstory. Paint the picture of who Maria Esperanza was on this, the anniversary of her great birth.
I'd be happy to do that. And before I do that, though, I do want to note that, you know, those multiple trips that you made to Venezuela and the subsequent interviews that you did, which were transcribed, have become invaluable in this process, this beatification process, and learning the story of Maria Esperanza. Because she, in those interviews with you, the questions you asked, she opened up on some topics and some areas that even her family didn't know much about. And because it was, you know, it was before they were born or when they were young children. And so I we continue to reparvest from the interviews that you did and are able to expound on the stories, expound on the life and virtues of Maria Esperanza because of those stories. So that was really, wow, that was really a wonderful investment that continues to reap the profits.
Oh, praise God. We had her daughter on. Esperancita was with us a couple weeks ago, too.
She did.
For Betania, too. And, gosh, it feels like family. I'm so glad to have you here. But I'm going to shut up so you can talk. I want you to introduce everyone to this extraordinary woman and share whatever you'd like.
Yes. Well, let's just do a quick bio for her. You spoke about her mystical gifts. Well, she was born in the central area of Venezuela. And her father died when she was rather young, and she moved with her mom and her siblings to Caracas. And there she, her gifts started to become apparent at a pretty young age. In fact, even at age 12, she had a near-death experience. She had severe heart problems that the doctors wasn't sure was going to pull through. And she had an encounter with Our Lady at that point and just surrendered herself to Our Lady. Was cured, healed, but in that surrender, Our Lady invited her to help her save souls. So from very early on, she had a mission of evangelization that was very Marian oriented, and that continued to grow. Even in her teens, she started to have this ability to predict that when relatives were coming. You know, this is, you know, some of those places and have, you know, a lot of phone usage, and people would just stop in and say hello to relatives. She would predict the coming of aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth, and right on time they would show. These gifts developed over time, and when she was in her mid-20s, then she felt that, you know, she wanted to give her life completely and exclusively to Jesus. And so she joined the convent on the west side of the country of Venezuela, a Franciscan convent. She was only there, less than 2 weeks when it was made clear to her through supernatural means that was not her calling. She was not meant to be enclosed in the monastery, in the convent there. Beautiful as a vocation that is, that was not her calling. And, you know, blessed be God, you know, for us, because, you know, Maria Esperanza was then able, as a lay person, to be available to so many tens of thousands of souls upon whom she had an impact, upon whom she may have healed, upon whom she may have given perfect counsel, upon whose lives or marriages she may have reconciled. So these, you know, God knows what he's doing. In any case, Maria Esperanza was called to Rome. She went to Rome. Now, this is a young girl, you know, traveling in the early 50s to Rome, and and just going there out of sheer faith. A priest in Venezuela helped her to find a hospice with some sisters, and so that's where she resided. In the meantime, she became quite known in the Vatican, believe it or not. It was in a rather hidden way. And so when she would enter the, well, she had finally met through providential circumstances her future husband, J.O.B. and Keeney, which is a whole beautiful story. That in itself would make an awesome movie. You should make that someday, Drew. Yeah. Tremendous story. But in any case, when she walked into the Vatican in St. Peter's Basilica with J.O., when he first met her, he was just dumbfounded at how all of the guards, all of the security personnel, all of the ushers knew her and paid reverence to her, this young woman. He didn't understand that, but she evidently her reputation for sanctity and special gifts had penetrated even to there. And although she speaks of, I mean, we don't have any real concrete way to substantiate this, but she probably had at least one or more encounters with Pope Pius XII. In any case, it was Pope Pius XII that allowed Maria Speranza to have her marriage, her wedding, in the Immaculate Conception Basilica Cathedral, Immaculate Conception Chapel in St. Peter's Basilica, which was an extraordinary permission, very, very rarely granted, but it was granted for her. And so she was married there to J.O.B. and Keeney. They lived a little while in Italy and then came back to Venezuela. Now, this is when things started to accelerate, shall we say, in terms of her mission and what God was calling her to do, because she had established a prayer group in Venezuela, and many people there Friday night, she would pray the rosary and people would come and pray with her and want to be in her company and seek her counsel and prophecy and so forth. Well, Our Lady had promised that one day she would find a land, and this land would be very significant, even on a global level. And that was the land you were talking about earlier, which is Betania. It was when Maria Speranza was finally confirmed that this was the land was Our Lady was talking about. It's about 50 kilometers south or so, southeast of Caracas. It was a sugarcane plantation in the mountains. You know, it's kind of like tropical mountain area there. Yeah. And so the turning point of this mission of Maria Speranza occurred on March 25th, 1981. She was there with about 150 people. A priest was with them. They had just celebrated Mass in the afternoon, and they were praying together, and then they just started to take a little lunch. And the children ran over to this open area now, which is we call the grotto. It's in front of a rock formation that has a little waterfall coming down it and shrouded by foliage. And the children were playing some soccer. All of a sudden, they come running back to their parents and said, "Mommy, Mommy, Daddy, there's a lady over here. There's a lady over here." So the, Maria Speranza said, "Guess everybody, let's go over and take a look." So 150 people went over that afternoon. And there, in front of that rock formation, the Blessed Mother appeared to all of them seven times for about five or seven minutes apiece between them, between 3 and 6 p.m. or so. The last apparition where they were with Our Lady was 20 minutes long. They thought Our Lady was never going to leave them, and they felt like they were in heaven, and they were visited by heaven. And this was so transformative in their life. Of course, Maria Speranza knew it was going to happen, But from there, when everybody went back to their homes in Caracas and other places and told the story, it erupted into a major drama, shall we say, a major ecclesial drama. The people were claiming, 150 people claiming to have seen Our Blessed Mother there in Venezuela, in Betania. So the bishop, who at that time, Bishop Pio Bello, you know him because you interviewed him several times, Bishop Pio Bello Ricardo, was compelled to bring about an investigation, which he decided to conduct himself. He said, "It's going to, with all these witnesses, it's going to be impossible to try to pull a committee. You know how you know about committees, I'm sure. It's hard to pull a committee together for a meeting, for a parish council meeting, all right? So imagine interviewing 150 people with theologians and everybody. But he was well qualified to do it himself because he had his doctorate in an area where he specialized in parapsychology. And so he was a Jesuit. Had been a university professor. He was an excellent theologian, and so he undertook this. But to be honest with you, he was extremely skeptical from the beginning, extremely skeptical. In fact, he could be quite harsh, quite abrupt with the witnesses. So when Maria Speranza and J.O. Bianchini, her husband, were interviewed as, you know, one of the 150, he was quite rude to them. I mean, rude is the right word, and dismissive of the claims. But what happened is testimony after testimony, engineers, medical doctors, psychologists, there were even atheists there confirming the same story, college students, ordinary folks from the village, all these people across every strata of society announcing the same or professing the same vision, the same experience of this encounter with this woman. He couldn't just write it off. So he continued his study for 2.5 years, and he made several trips to Rome to speak to then Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, about this whole issue. And he was given a specific book. You were going to interrupt? I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
Yeah, no, Father, just hold the thought. I'm up against the clock. I think just a short pause here. Let's pick it up on the other side. My guest, Father Tim Byerly, we're talking today about Servant of God, Maria Speranza. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Hey, thank you for joining me. It is good to be here with you today. If you're just getting plugged in, we will pray the chaplet in about 10 minutes. But reflecting back today on a woman who had a profound impact on my life and on my spirituality. Her name was Maria Speranza. She came from a place where the Mother of God appeared, not just to her, but to the masses. It's a church-approved apparition. This very site was a reported Eucharistic miracle that Bishop Pio Bello also had investigated, found it to be, another great miracle, another extension of God's grace. And I'd never met anyone like Maria Speranza before. And I've invited today the vice postulator for her cause, Father Tim Byerly, to join me. He wrote a book, by the way. If you want to check this out, if you want to learn all of this, we're only going to be able to scratch the surface of what is a fascinating story and how God is really working in the world today and through the lives of those who say yes. And Maria had many charisms. Her family was such a beautiful fruit. The love that she showed everyone, there was a warmth. And I know she's a powerful intercessor for us today. The book that Father wrote is called Maria Speranza and the Grace of Betania. Maria Speranza and the Grace of Betania. Father, as you know, we probably have about 8 minutes or so. So let me do this. Why don't you pick up your story where you left off with the bishop? But then also, I'm curious as to where her cause is. I was there when her cause was opened in New Jersey when she became a servant of God. But the church has this process, as you know. And maybe you can bring everybody up to speed on where we are and you know, how we can in some way help.
Yes. Well, we have 8 minutes, so I'm going to compress the story of Maria Speranza. I want to highlight the fact that Bishop Pio Bello investigated that apparition, all the apparitions there were more than one, but particularly that day, March 25th, 1981. He did a very extensive examination under the guidance of Cardinal Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, who was also, of course, in consultation with John Paul II on this. So November the 21st in 1987, the Bishop Pio Bello declared the apparitions in Betania as authentic, of supernatural character from God, which is a huge, what shall we say? That is an extremely positive embrace of the reality of the supernatural occurrences there. And so the church allows us then to have devotion to Our Lady under the title Reconciler of All Peoples and Nations, the title she came to Britannia under. And we look to, especially to the servant of God, Mirasponsu, who was the central visionary of that apparition. So Mirasponsu then was blasted onto the world scene and began to make a lot of pilgrimages to various places, actually invited to give missions. She came often to New Jersey and other places in the United States of America. Her fame of sanctity spread. She was sought out by thousands of people for counsel, for healing, for prayer, for prophecy, and so forth. So that was so impactful in people's lives that when Mirasponsu was called home to God, there was an immediate interest in initiating her beatification cause. Now, it's important to mention that she didn't die in her home nation of Venezuela. She died in New Jersey. She died in Long Beach Island, New Jersey, on August the 7th, 2004. She was up here on a mission. Her health had been declining. She was unable health-wise to return home and eventually passed away here after a period of time. And her whole family came up for the occasion to be with her, I should say, until the end of her life. So now that was 2004. So on January 31st, 2010, her beatification cause was opened in the Diocese of Metuchen, New Jersey. And it was about 1,200 people there. You were there. It was a splendid and magnificent moment of grace. And then there was we started going pretty strong with a cause on a number of aspects, and then interest cooled a little bit there were some changes of personnel and so forth. And it seemed that you know, we were stalled. And now there's been a renewed interest and a renewed passing of the baton and picking up with renewed zeal the beatification cause of Mirasponsu in Caracas, in the Archdiocese of Caracas. The cardinal, the new cardinal down there, is very excited about the cause. And the priest, Father Barachini, who is they have an office, a title for him. He's called the vicar for beatification causes, canonization causes for the Archdiocese. And so this priest has a parish in the center of Caracas, and he has begun these monthly masses in memory of the servant of God, Mirasponsu. And every month they have a mass invoking her intercession, and then two or three testimonies, people who knew her, to speak about her life. So it's become a center of promotion of the life, virtues, knowledge, awareness of Mirasponsu in the country, the nation in which she was, she lived her life, was born and lived her life. So this is a tremendous development, and we are very thrilled about it, and we are just watching it move forward. There's no way to put a time on it. There's no way to say, you know, how long it's going to take, or, you know, so forth. The favors continue to come to be reported, Drew. Favors of an amazing healings, amazing reconciliations, amazing rectifications of disasters and things in people's lives through the intercession of Servant God Mirasponsu. So I would say to your listeners, she is a go-to intercessor right now, especially for the family, because that was her particular mission, to unite families. And she called for the reconciliation of the whole human family, one family at a time.
I love that. You know, I'm glad you said that. We're about to pray the chaplet, and we'll certainly pray for your intentions, but I think that's so important. You know, Sister Lucia de Santos, Father, and I've often mentioned this, she did an interview with Cardinal Caffara, I think in the 1940s or something, and she said the final confrontation will be over marriage and family. And we see that right now. And Maria, you know, she exemplified what a true, loving family was really all about. And I've got somebody who's in real need of prayer. I'm going to turn to her and ask for her intercession. And I hope others will do the same thing. Your book, if people want to learn more, and I'll have to bring it back. There's so much we could talk about. But if people want to get your book, what's the best way to connect to it? Where will they find it?
From Batania 2, www.batania, regular alphanumeric 2, not a Roman numeral 2, regular 2, .com. Dot org.
So that's BETANIA2. BETANIA2.org. And Maggie, maybe you could put that up on our Twitter page. So if anyone follows us on Twitter, you'll find it there. It'll bring you over. And Father's book, give him the title again, Father, if you could.
The title is Maria Speranza and the Grace of Batania. It covers her life's history. As it speaks, there's a whole chapter on her mystical gifts. And then it speaks about her mission of reconciliation, beginning with the family, then and healing the whole of the human race by focusing on the family and healing one family at a time.
I always love the title that the Virgin came under. She came as the reconciler of peoples and nations. And boy, we need that more than ever today. Father, thank you. Have a blessed Thanksgiving if we don't talk. Great to have you here today.
Same to you, Drew. God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Let's pray the chaplet.